Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
A beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Dr. Tao Lee Goff, author of Dark Laboratory, on Columbus, the Caribbean, and the origins of the climate crisis. Part memoir, part cultural reportage, and part social study, Dark Laboratory radically transforms how we conceive of Blackness, the natural world, colonialism, and the climate crisis by centering the imagination and play. Dark Laboratory is a new ontology for both the old world and the future world we are all hoping to inhabit. Tao, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Hi, Lauren. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. Let's start with this book's title, Dark Laboratory. I want to break down these words, and given your note on terminology at the beginning of the book, I'm going to presume that you'll be okay with this. Tell me about the different ways the work that you do is represented by the word dark, and how you've come to interpret and understand the word lab, or laboratory.
Thanks for that question. I love language. I joke that I'm a recovering English major. So etymology is really fun for me to dig into. I did study English as an undergrad at Princeton. So I had to take all those classes on Shakespeare and was fascinated by the trope of the dark lady. But yeah, I feel there's such a kind of mystique to this idea of the dark. Mm-hmm. And I think of it in terms of interiority, but I think there's also a fear of the dark and a fear of race, especially in this current climate politically, mm-hmm. with talk of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But the title of the book is drawn from Toni Morrison and her 1992 book that is titled Playing in the Dark, which is about the American literary imagination. So I was very privileged in 2008, another election year, to take a class with her at Princeton.
Wow.
And it was a literary criticism class, so not a creative writing class. And my lab, so to move to the next word, is really based on her style of teaching, which was the atelier method, derived from French styles of workshopping. So I see the lab as an active place. I break down laboratory to emphasize labor as the first part of the word and try to encourage students to think about collective labor and what can be born out of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that touches on some of the conceptual grounds of the title of the book, and also the fact that Dark Lab is an actual place. We're located at Hunter College, where I teach as an associate professor in Black Studies.
Hmm. You mentioned labor, and I want to return to ideas of labor and what it has to do with this particular book. But I love the idea of the Dark Lab, the Dark Laboratory, being kin with playing in the dark, especially because you encourage so much play, so much creativity within this laboratory, within these pages, and within the research space. That's fascinating. Before we get too far into our conversation, I want to make sure we're grounding our listeners in place. Will you talk about the region, or regions, rather, that you're writing about, that you're diving into here, as well as your own relationship to them?
Yeah, I'm happy to literally dive in because this book really goes underwater, and I see it as a love letter to and from islands. So I begin with my island stories, and it's a story of four groups of islands. So I was born in the UK, which is obviously part of the British Isles. We can think about the North Sea, but also about the Atlantic, and those kinds of haunted crossings. Hmm. When we consider the transatlantic trade of enslaved Africans, and I'm a descendant of that commerce, and the book considers the plantation economy. So coming back to labor, it's a big part of the argument when I talk about the climate crisis. So that takes us to the second set of islands, which is New York. And that's where I live and moved to as a child. So I think most people are not aware that New York City is an archipelago, which is to say it's a chain of islands, over 40 islands. And I'm constantly thinking about the shorelines of this place across deep time, which I explore in the book. And then the third set of islands are the Caribbean. And I really, sit with the fact that my mother was born in Jamaica before it became independent from the United Kingdom. And I consider the kind of colonial legacies, therefore, when we consider climate risk and hurricane season in places like that. The fourth set of islands that I explore in the book are off the coast of southern China. Mm-hmm. So the South China Sea and Hong Kong, where my grandfather grew up and where other parts of my family are from. So the climate risks there are equally terrifying when we think about rising sea levels, flooding, typhoons, and really the book is just, really global in scope. And it looks to islands for both the origins of the climate crisis, but also for the potential solutions to the climate crisis.
Before I forget, you've just mentioned this idea of deep time. And you write in the book that if we embrace a nonlinear understanding of time, there are multiple origins and apocalypses, and that in the small details of the island, the finite scale of colonial time becomes apparent to you. So you're writing about timelines of apocalypse, about coral time in another place in the book, about geologic time, about deep time. Will you talk about the ways that time is integral to the arguments that you're making about the climate crisis?
Sure. I mean, I'm very thrilled to be joining you on Mountain Time.
Yeah.
I got a little confused because I joke that I'm not very good at arithmetic and time zones because they are a construct of the 19th century. And we can actually pinpoint when it was that the prime meridian became, you know, GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, and became the zero kind of starting place of the world clock. And I think a lot of that does have to do with plantation time, the time of capitalism, the time of optimization and efficiency. So a lot of my book is, I like to joke, everything, everywhere, all at once, like that movie, because, I'm embracing maybe like a multiverse. My students joke that there's the Tao Li Goff multiverse when it comes to the lab, and where we have members, over 30 members across different time zones, from Helsinki and Finland to Hilo in Hawaii. And the work is multimodal, and it's also embracing nonlinear time, such as Nigerian Yoruba temporality, and just different ways of understanding history, not necessarily as this linear kind of arc of progress. I think there's been a lot of disillusionment with that, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic began. And I think we have to kind of let go of these preconceived notions of time and progress in order to actually find these solutions for what feels like this cascading and inevitable climate crisis. So I take a lot of hope in kind of thinking about the fact that many Black and Native peoples have survived past world-ending events and apocalypses. So I think that it should show there's hope for all of us if it is possible to live beyond the seeming apocalypse.
Will you clarify or dive a little bit deeper into what you mean by letting go of time, about letting go of this construct? What does that look like?
I think it's tricky, of course, because standardization helps us to communicate. Mm-hmm. I've had students when I taught at NYU come to office hours and say, "Oh, Prof. Goff, I just want to let you know that I don't conform to colonial time, so I may be late to class. I will try my best to be there." And I've told them that, you know, this is the schedule. We need things to be, you know, fair for everyone. So, yeah, they kind of catch me on the conceptual grounds of what we're challenging, which I think is funny. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have to let go of time, and to understand how it's measured differently in different traditions. So I look to my own Chinese heritage, and I've understood how incense is a way of marking time in a lot of Asian cultures. And that's to do with ancestor worship. So the amount of time that it takes for incense to burn, mm-hmm. Could be one metric. There are different kinds of clocks in different traditions. And really, again, it's in 1885 that we begin to see this standardization of time. And it's the same moment that we see the scramble for Africa and the Berlin Conference and this kind of dividing up of the so-called darker nations, so Asia and Africa, in apparently arbitrary demarcations that have led to a lot of conflict. So I think that, time is a vexing question. And I've written an article called Stolen Life, Stolen Time. And it really was a way to think about how we can steal time back. And I think, again, since the pandemic, a lot of people have been trying to steal time back for themselves. And one way that I tried to do it as a fundraiser and as a lab director is by fundraising, because I do think time is money. So if I'm able to fund artists and artists in residence at the lab, I feel like I can give people creative time back, because there's such a kind of bureaucratic time, administrative time, that is the antithesis or the opposite of creative time. So if I can give anyone the gift of time for creativity, for rest, then I feel like that's a really wonderful use of my time.
Yeah, I really love that reconceptualization of time. It makes sense to me. I want to go back, Tao, to identity, to personhood. Yours sits at the intersection of Black and Chinese cultures, brought into contact specifically through British colonialism. And I think I'm sort of pulling at a thread that we haven't yet introduced to our listeners, but will you talk about how the Chinese economy intersects Jamaican climate infrastructure and maybe the Jamaican economy more broadly? I found that really fascinating in the book.
Sure. I mean, this is the topic of my dissertation when I studied for my PhD in American Studies at Yale. And it's a topic I think I'll be writing about for the rest of my life, mm-hmm. the convergence of China and Jamaica, and especially these two British colonial spaces, so Hong Kong mm-hmm. and Jamaica being two tropical islands that were part of the British Empire. So I really just sit with the fact that there's a kind of specter, a kind of fear of China taking over the Caribbean. But I want to prompt readers to understand that there's a deeper history long before the 21st century. It's my own personal history of Chinese shopkeepers in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. So though the Chinese are a small minority population across the Caribbean, they've been quite prominent in the business sector. And it's complicated. It's the subject of my next book, which is called Black Capital, Chinese Debt. But again, these labor questions stem from the plantation economy and from a moment of freedom for Black people who were enslaved, who are also my ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So when you drive to, or when you fly into Kingston, which is the capital city of Jamaica, and you drive from the airport into the main city, there are these huge boulders along the highway. And they were actually installed by the Chinese government and Chinese corporations to stop the road from flooding. So literally in the geology and the infrastructure, we can see that China is present in the Caribbean and helping them against the climate risks that are ever present as hurricane season becomes more and more severe. So this book, Dark Laboratory, does a lot to analyze that presence. And it's a presence of the Chinese in the Caribbean over 200 years at this point. So I really wrote the book to give some context to that history, which is also part of my family history.
You're listening to A Conversation with Dr. Tao Li Goff. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. Let's talk about Christopher Columbus. He's right there in the subtitle. You claim that Columbus's arrival in the Caribbean in 1492 was the beginning of globalization, of the climate crisis as we know it, and not, as has been thought and taught, later dates of industrialization. So this idea, Tao, it proved pretty radical or pretty novel in the academic circles that you were in. Tell me about what that experience was like for you to push back on those kinds of long-held beliefs.
Yeah, it was not easy. Mm-hmm. I was lucky, as I mentioned, to be the student of Toni Morrison. And then the next year, I was a student of Tony Blair. And the course that he taught was called Faith in Globalization. And it was in this course that I began to understand my own family history as part of this question of modernity and globalization. And the timeline that we were being given for globalization was the 1970s onward. So it was an understanding of a moment at which the corners of the earth became closer to one another, and commerce was in full flow. But I pushed our class to consider that the four corners of the planet have long been in contact. And really, it was this quote-unquote Columbian exchange, the arrival of Columbus, that inaugurates the quote-unquote new world. So to go back to 1492 felt essential to me, because when I read that in 1493, when Columbus returned to the Caribbean after his first venture, he brought sugarcane. That really was significant in terms of understanding monocrop agriculture and the beginning of the plantation system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I draw on this claim about the origin of the climate crisis, because the logic of deforestation necessary to plant sugarcane in the way that it became cultivated across the Americas really began with him bringing that crop from India, where it's indigenous to.
Tao, then, what are the stakes of knowing that Columbus's arrival marked the beginning of the climate crisis instead of, say, these other dates of industrialization, the 1970s? Is it just that adjusting the start date or the cause adjusts then or moves the way that we go about our solutions or our solutions thinking? Does that make sense? What are the stakes?
Yeah, it does. And I think that, I guess, a lot of the book is philosophical and existential in the sense that if we can't agree on the origin, how can we expect to find a solution? Mm-hmm. So if we don't even know what the problem is, how can we collectively figure out how to change it? So for me, it's about understanding Columbus's mission, that, yes, he was Italian, but he was sailing for Ferdinand and Isabella. I think digging into his accounts, how he wrote about Native peoples, reveals a lot about this kind of justification for colonizing and seizing land. And really, I see the solution throughout the book as one of land back, mm-hmm. and one of oceans back, and returning sovereignty to the Native peoples that have been here. Because as we know, it was not the New World, it was new to him. Mm-hmm. But I think that in order to reverse what has taken place since then, we would have to really understand that this is a deeper problem than the 1970s. Another moment that people might turn to, and the cover of my book kind of gestures to that, could be the Industrial Revolution. And I think that the plantation economy actually tells us more than the Industrial Revolution necessarily about this logic of exhaustion. Because I think we need to begin with the exhaustion of the soil and the exhaustion of people, the transatlantic trade of enslaved Africans, to really understand the original sins of the Americas and what we need to be repairing.
I'm glad you used the phrase original sin. You dive, and I'm just going to keep using that verb, you dive into the idea of the islands, the Caribbean, as Eden. And I'm curious about the way you've approached the idea of lost or being lost as it relates to Eden and paradise, specifically in this book. Will you triangulate those ideas for me?
Sure. I mean, as you're saying it, I'm thinking about paradise lost. Mm-hmm. I was a religion major before I became an English major. Mm. So I often, think about a kind of feminist understanding of early Christianity because of the courses I took as an undergraduate that really centered or kind of gave like a three-legged chair understanding of feminism in early Christianity with the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, and Eve. So I've just been obsessed with what it means to understand the Garden of Eden as this perfect climate and environment, and then therefore to understand Adam and Eve as the first climate refugees. So to look to the Hebrew Bible and to understand that the first punishment by God was actually to be banished from this land of plenty into these barren lands, and that it was Eve's fault, feels just so rich with significance. Mm-hmm. So the book was originally called After Eden, and I'll also just say I've been writing it since 2017. So it's really evolved out of these ideas of a kind of Judeo-Christian structuring of our Western society and trying to grapple with the myths and the way that many different European nations were mapping this paradise sense of Eden onto the Caribbean. So to get lost is, I think, a kind of interesting puzzle because Columbus was lost, mm-hmm. and he didn't even know that he was lost. He thought that he was in Asia. And hence we have the misnaming of Indians because he thought he was in the Indies when he arrived in the Caribbean. And he died not even fully understanding or knowing that because he sailed south instead of west, or his calculations were incorrect. So he himself was lost. But then I talk in the first chapter of the book about meeting a Maroon chief. So the Maroons were enslaved Africans who escaped from the Spaniards in places like Jamaica in the 1600s. And they have maintained their sovereignty for centuries, especially in mountain regions. So I had the pleasure to meet a man named Colonel Sterling. And he said to me, "You cannot get lost out here." And I was nervous because I'm not a very good hiker. And It was just so profound. It was probably a throwaway statement for him. But yeah, to be lost is, it's a matter of orientation and interpretation. And what if we've been sold this idea of being lost so that someone can sell us a map? Mm-hmm. What if there's no real way to get lost in the wilderness because it's really a matter of each step not being a wrong step, but that it's a place where you can find your way and sort of just immerse yourself in nature.
We've sort of touched on different fears. You were talking about Toni Morrison's playing in the dark, being afraid of the dark, being afraid of getting lost. I'm wondering, Tao, if you've considered fear and the implications of fear in further solutions to the climate crisis.
Yeah, I really am enjoying your questions because I think they touch on affect and emotion.
Yes.
I end the book with fear and also surrender, to come back to, you know, surrendering to time or letting go of time. The book details a near-death experience that I had with my sister and cousin. We were all aged around 10. And we almost drowned. So on Long Island, the beach was empty except for our parents who couldn't swim. And we were on a sandbar. And the riptides pulled us out to sea, such that the sand, the ground under our feet was no longer there. And for me, that fear really does have a parallel with, I think, a lot of the climate anxiety that people are feeling about the climate crisis. And it feels to many like a foregone conclusion, like it's inevitable. But I wrote this book, Dark Laboratory, out of a radical sense of optimism that all hope is not lost. Yes, we are in a dire place. I write about just the memory of the waves coming over us as children. So back when I was on that sandbar and kind of just realizing or feeling that no one was going to come for us as the waves came up and down over our heads, and I didn't know how to swim. But a lifeguard who was off duty happened to be running down the beach. I think he was just going for a jog, and he saved us at the very last minute. So I think that we have to confront the fear, acknowledge it, maybe surrender to it, but then also continue to keep a kind of hope that climate redemption is possible.
That was Dr. Tao Lee Goff, author of Dark Laboratory, on Columbus, the Caribbean, and the origins of the climate crisis. Out now from Doubleday, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Tao, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.